Call this meeting to Judiciary Committee to order. Members take your seats. Chair recognizes a quorum. We have two policy bills up today. Oh, no, we're working on two policy-only omnibus bills, civil law and data practices. So, members, you should plan on working evenings the week of March 4th through 8th and 11th through 15th. It all depends on how we can do that. But that's leading up to the first deadline. Our goal is then to have evening sessions only the week leading up to the third deadline, which is the week of April 8th to 12th. So we do have the two bills today. I'm the chief author of both. The reason for that is these were Representative Zerwas's bills last year. And I had versions of them in years prior to that when we were in the majority. And I'll explain more about them when I get up there. But first, before we do the minutes, I want to introduce you to, we have a permanent page now. We're working on some other stuff, but Kate Cavalier, can you stand up and give a wave to the folks? Kate Cavalier is going to be our page for this committee, and I think we're working on getting another one. Is that right? But did you want to take the mic and just tell committee members just a little bit about yourself? I totally blind. You don't want to do it? You don't have to. Okay. Well, just give a wave then. Kate's great.
We'd love to hear from you.
Thank you. Okay, welcome. What's that? Okay. Are they here or are they watching on TV? Okay, where are the 12th grade students from Rivers Eagle Academy in St. Paul? Rivers Edge, sorry. Rivers Eagle? Sorry about that. It's her writing. It's her fault. Okay. Rivers Edge Academy in St. Paul. They're participating in the Capitol Historic Sites Voice of the People, Your Role in Minnesota Government Tour and Education Program. Welcome today. Thanks for being here. So next order of business is approval of the minutes from February 13th. Is there a motion? Chair Considine moves the minutes of February 13th. Any discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Minutes of February 13th are approved. I'm now going to hand over the gavel to Vice Chair Mueller. As soon as I find my talking points here. Here we go.
All right, members, the bill we'll be hearing first is House File 1060, a bill authorizing the reduction or waiver of the criminal and traffic surcharge in certain instances, requiring courts to consider indigency or hardship before imposing certain fines, fees, or surcharges. And Chair Lesh, would you like to move this bill, House File 1060, before the committee to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee with a recommendation that it be re-referred to the Public Safety Criminal Justice Reform Committee?
Madam Chair, that is my motion.
All right. With that, Chair Lesh, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. You know, I may blindside Mr. Walls with this too, but I'm going to have a question relating to when we started imposing these, which I think started these fees partially in 2003 and 2005. There might have been another increase in 2007. And all those budget-cutting years. Remember when we were solving the budget deficit without raising taxes? Well, you know, this is what we raised. And the reason for it at the time was because public safety needed to be funded. We thought the best way to do it would be to, instead of going to the general fund, is to put these fees on folks that come through the court system. And that has resulted in a substantial set of problems. So I first started prosecuting back in 2001 for the city of St. Paul, and I prosecuted a lot of these driving after revocation, driving after suspension cases, driving after cancellation. And what happened is because we were trying to solve the budget deficit without raising taxes, we had to require that these be imposed on everyone. Well, if you're talking about low-income folks who are probably in court because they couldn't pay a traffic fine in the first place, they can't pay their traffic fines, and then they get their license suspended. because they didn't pay their fines. And then, of course, they keep driving because they're going to work, they're dropping off their kid or whatever. And so now they get a driving after suspension, and they have to plead guilty to that because they were driving while their license was suspended. And now their license is revoked on top of being suspended because they broke the law by driving after suspension. And then at each one of these stages, they have fees that are stacked up. And we required that those fees be imposed because we had to solve the budget deficit, you know, without raising taxes, right? And it just got to be ridiculous, this snowballing scenario of fees that people who really weren't in a position to pay being ordered to pay because that's what state government said in order to, you know, fund the general fund. So that's how it started. Now, those were all the budget-cutting deficit years, 2001, 2003. I think we had a very small surplus in 2007, back to deficit 9. And we finally corrected that in 2013. So it was a full 10 years of this. And my thought was there were all these nickel and dime things that we did on the budget deficit, especially with the huge one in 2003, $5.4 billion between the shortfall in the current biennium and then the budget. And I said there were all those cuts. We had to do all kinds of really bad things. But now that we have a surplus, we should be able to correct some of that. I mean, we corrected the school shift. We replenished the reserve. We did all these things. Now, we have not solved the inflation on the spending side of the forecast, but there are still some of these hidden little gems of I shouldn't use the word, but they're bad things that have happened, and I want to be able to solve them, okay? This doesn't solve the whole thing that we did, okay? This does not remove the $75 state surcharge that is still going to the general fund in order to support public safety, but it does give judges the ability to waive that surcharge or offer a community service alternative in the case of financial hardship so that these people don't get into the same cycle that I just described. So it requires judges to consider the ability to pay before setting the amount of the fine, and it adds language to the standard citation form notifying people of their right to ask for a reduction in the cost. So the 75 state surcharge drives the cost of a basic traffic ticket to 130. Judges already have discretion on most fines and fees, but are prohibited by law from reducing the surcharge, even in cases of severe financial hardship, because of what I told you, because of those budget-cutting years where we said, no, you can't do it, because we were padding that into the budget to make sure that we balanced. And we have a surplus now, so we should be able to correct that. It makes clients eligible for a public defender. They have a less than 50% default rate on, or greater than 50% default rate on the surcharge, which leads to a collections process that is costly both for individuals and the state. And right-sizing these fines will lead to a lower default rate, fewer collections cases, and may even increase collection rates. So that's what we're on 1060 now, right?
That's correct.
Okay, that's what this bill does. And that's why I brought it. That's why Representative Zerwas had it last year. I think it makes sense. Members, I've seen these folks cycle through the court system. They're not the type of people that we really want to waste our time with. I look in Mensis and I see people who have no other offenses, no other crimes, but there's this long list of driving after suspension, driving after revocation. These are not criminals, okay? But the courts say that they are because they were driving after suspension because they got to get their kids to daycare, they got to get to work. And I will tell you this, in my days prosecuting, for the longest time, the first one we treated as a petty routinely. After that, we made them plead to a misdemeanor. On the third one, it was another misdemeanor. We were stacking them. And then on the fourth one, you were getting jail time, and it was 15 days of jail time for your fourth one. Okay? And if you're poor, and if you have a broken taillight, you can't afford to fix the broken taillight, that is the predicate for the stop, for getting pulled over. So you're going to get stopped more if you can't afford to fix your broken taillight. And then guess what? You're driving a suspended license. These days we have automatic license plate readers. So they could scan the whole time and just pick one up. Oh, there's one. Pick them out. And they stop. Now, we're getting a different culture in the police department now where they're starting to realize that they don't just want to necessarily waste a lot of court time or a lot of law enforcement time on these folks because they're not generally the criminal element that we're talking about. But it's still in the law that we have to do that. So we shouldn't, I don't think, be given 15 days of jail time for the fourth one and then 3 days stacked for every day thereafter. Anyway, with that, I'd like to introduce
Jeanette Berner.
Jeanette, thank you, Jeanette.
Thank you. And before you do that, I believe Representative Johnson has a question.
I'll wait till the testifier.
Okay, great. Go ahead, then. Please introduce yourself and state your name for the record.
Thank you. I'm Jeanette Berner. I'm the first assistant public defender in Hennepin County. Thank you for having me here today. I speak on behalf of the public defenders in the state of Minnesota. As many of you know, we are the largest criminal defense firm in the state of Minnesota. You might be surprised or might not be surprised to know that statewide we represent 57% of all criminal cases in the state, and in Hennepin County the number is higher at 61%. A little bit about who our clients are. Our clients are eligible because they are below the federal poverty guidelines. And just to put a little bit of a face on that for you, that means that a family of four is earning less than $25,000 a year, an individual less than $12,000 a year. But to put a better face on that for you, many of our clients are homeless. They haven't had shelter or they're between shelter. They're unemployed or underemployed, and they're, frankly, without food. And that is a large percentage, particularly in the metro area, of people who are we represent. Sorry.
Welcome, Representative Lucero, and happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Glad you dressed for the occasion.
That's usually like a prosecutor's trial tactic, but whatever. Okay. I'll move forward. To give you a little bit sort of a purview on the justice system, I think it's important for all of you to understand that judges impose fines as a form of punishment. That's why they impose fines. They are required by law to exercise discretion and consider the facts presented in making all sentencing decisions. Imposing a standard fine and a mandatory surcharge without considering ability to pay removes judicial discretion and the perception of fairness by our clients. It has a much greater impact on poor people because zero is not an option, yet some have zero means to pay. The court has to be empowered to consider the ability to pay or it erodes the integrity of our overall sentencing if the court cannot consider the person before her. And I will say anecdotally, in our practice, and Ms. Hang from the city will tell you, that judges feel very frustrated at the time of sentencing that they are not allowed discretion in that venue. And I hope you would imagine that that really does erode fairness in the system. So the state surcharge waiver is the particular issue before you, and that is that it is written as mandatory. There is no matter what the individual circumstance of the person who comes before the court. It is administrative, so it really is punitive, but it's built in as an administrative fee, which really is somewhat illogical. It's a deal breaker in negotiations. We could have a case where we are on the cusp of resolving and not having continued court appearance, which are very expensive for the system. And when the client learns that the one thing that cannot be changed is the $75 surcharge, often they pull out of that negotiation and move that case to another step, hoping for a better day, a better resolution, a dismissal, or something that doesn't require that that payment. It is more often than not, and I would submit to you this is sort of bizarre, but it is more often than not greater than the actual fine. So a judge can assess ability to pay, and they often do in Hennepin County, and, for example, administer a fine of $25, yet the surcharge is $75, and it really makes no practical sense. Just to give you an example, we had a case last year. A woman was charged with 5 trespassing cases for riding the light rail in the winter because she didn't have a home. She was brought into court to face the 5 charges, and at that point she was triaged into one of our restorative-type courts and was offered the ability to have 3 of the cases dismissed upon a plea to 2, not serve any additional time, and if she agreed to accept social services. That was the offer from the city, who acknowledged her particular circumstances and wanted to get her back on her feet. After that resolution is said and done, she walked away with those two convictions, but she also walked away with a surcharge of $150, which was sort of shocking to her and, frankly, all of us in the system, because she's riding a light rail because she has nowhere to live. And those are the kind of, that's just one example of the cases that we see every day that causes us all tremendous frustration. So I would just close by saying that in Hennepin County, and I sometimes hate to say that because people are like, yeah, it's the Hennepin County exception, but I would just like to say that judges mostly do look at ability to pay. And I think if we could build that into the surcharge and impose that or ask for that to happen statewide, then I think all of our clients statewide would receive that equitable treatment with regard to their individual circumstances. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Barner. Let's see. Chair Lesh, do you have another testifier?
Do you want to add anything?
Yep. Come on forward. Welcome. Please Thank introduce you. Yourself to the committee.
My name is Mary Ellen Hing. I am the criminal deputy at the Minneapolis City Attorney's Office. And I'm not going to repeat a lot of what's said. I agree with everything that's been said by both Chair Lesh and Jeanette. I've been a prosecutor since 1997, so almost 22 years now. And when I started, what Chair Lesh was referencing to, the surcharge was around $30. And then it went up to 33, and then it went up to 38, and then it did make that big jump to 75 sometime in the early 2000s. And so when it was low, we've always had a surcharge, but when it was low, the other thing to remember about a lot of these cases is we have a large group of tickets that are called payables. So there's a state set amount of fine, usually about $50 for a traffic ticket, plus the surcharge. Back when the surcharge was lower, you would get a speeding ticket and your total would be under $100. And I don't have any data to back this up, but just my own experience of what I've seen is I think for a lot of people that had means, they were like, that seems reasonable. People would take their lump, say, yep, I sped, they'd pay the ticket. We wouldn't see them in court. We see a lot of people challenging tickets, really, I think, purely for the financial reason. Even people that have the ability to pay, because I think it's a philosophical thing for them. The ticket seems too high for what they've done. And I echo one of my biggest frustrations as a prosecutor is, you know, we're trying to find appropriate consequences for people for the behavior. And when an administrative fee is higher than the penalty that we're imposing, I just have a big philosophical issue with that. I think that's just wrong. And oftentimes, at least in my office, what we have done just as our general practice is we don't negotiate fines very often. The only time we do is on, say, if it's a speeding ticket and it's like a very high speed or something and we really want to have that consequence, we might negotiate a specific fine. But we frequently leave the fine up to the court because we know the court's going to impose zero fine because they have this surcharge that they have to impose. And we know adding fines on top of that for a lot of the clients that we deal with, most of the cases we deal with are represented by the public defender. It's just going to continue to add on to the burden for them. And so we don't even negotiate fines anymore for a lot of cases. And the other thing is, and I don't know if this is true around the state, but when someone has a fine or prosecution costs imposed plus a surcharge, and that person, a lot of times I think in their mind, they need to pay off that fine or prosecution cost first. That's the penalty. So they bring in, a lot of times it's $50. They bring in that $50, and when you look in the court record, what does the court do? They apply that $50 to the surcharge first. They pay themselves first. Again, that is another thing that I have a big issue with. Doesn't necessarily have to do anything with the law, but that's the reality of what happens. And so then they still owe the fine, and there may be consequences for unpaying that, and that surcharge may get paid off. And so I understand why we have to have surcharges. I personally think it should be lower and should be less than the penalty amount. But with that said, at least we need to give the judges back discretion and allow them the opportunity to waive or lower or offer community service. We do that with fines. It works perfectly. It's all about giving a meaningful consequence. And if someone can't pay but they're willing to do 4 hours of community service, I'm fine with that as a prosecutor. It gives them a consequence for the behavior. We can all walk away feeling like we've got a positive resolution. And I know Representative Lesh came from the St. Paul City Attorney's Office. They've been working with us on this bill and the next one that's up, and I know they agree and support this bill as well. And so thank you for your consideration.
Great, thanks. And if you could just stick around for questions. And before we do that, Mr. Johnson, I believe you have some history about the surcharge.
Yes, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, just going briefly, the surcharge that we're talking about today appears in Section 357.021 as Subdivision 6. Based on my quick research here at the table, it looks like that particular subdivision was first put into law in 1998, at which point it was $25. It increased in 2001 to $35, increased again in 2003 to $60, increased in 2005 to $72, and increased again in 2008 to $75, which is where it is now. I'll simply add that that's the base surcharge. There have been on and off throughout years additional things like law library fees that are a few dollars. Ms. Hang mentioned these charges being about $3 more. Some of that is the law library fee that has come and gone over the years. But those numbers I just gave are sort of the base criminal traffic surcharge fee.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. And Mr. Wiles, I believe you have the fiscal note from last year. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, I'm currently looking at the fiscal note for a Zerwas bill, House File 3357, from the previous year that dealt with waiving surcharges and reducing the ability or the onus on the court to collect these fees. I haven't yet finished perusing it, but it does have a cost of $6 million a year. Some of that is lost revenue, and some of that is additional costs that the court is requesting for additional staff. But we're still waiting on the note to be completed on the bill as introduced this year. I don't know if the two bills have identical language.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Wells. Chair Johnson, or Chair Lesh, can you answer that question as to whether or not, oh, someone else is coming to court.
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead and state your name, please.
Hello, Madam Chair. I'm Anna Odegaard. I'm with the Minnesota Asset Building Coalition, and we've been working closely with Chairman Lesh on these bills. I believe what you quoted was correct. For the fiscal note on a very similar bill last year, there was some language in that bill that would have required folks on that payables list that Mary Ellen just referenced, who did not pay that fine on time, to be required to show up in court so that an assessment of ability to pay could be conducted. That was our intent. Our intent was not for folks whose violation is on the payables list to need to show up in court. It was just for folks who did have a hearing on a violation that they did have the opportunity to have their assessment to pay, their ability to pay be assessed. So a lot, the extra staff charge was based on that kind of different interpretation of the language. We did work with Mr. Johnson, in fact, to change that language so that folks whose violation is on the payables list will not be required to come into court, and that would eliminate the staff cost on that fiscal note, which was a significant portion of it. There still will be a cost in foregone revenue, although we've also been working with some researchers on determining exactly how much the state is collecting from public defender cases each year on the surcharge, using that as a proxy for who might receive that waiver or reduction of the surcharge. We are waiting for an updated fiscal note for this year, but we anticipate it might be about $1.5 million a year in foregone revenue based on the amount of funding that the state is collecting on public defender cases on that surcharge currently.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. We had some other questions ahead of yours.
Oh,
that's all right. All right. I believe Representative Johnson, you were first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also had problems. When I started my law enforcement career in 1985, it was before these surcharges were on. A speeding ticket was about, if you're doing 15 over the speed limit, it was about $45. And the one testifier, the prosecutor's day, hit exactly what I was going to hit on. These surcharges, besides this surcharge we're talking about, is way too high. Then we have the library fees, law library fees, there's a couple other fees. And if I remember right correctly, Hennepin Ramsey County also has some other fees on top of that. But in where I was, because of the fees, the seatbelt statute says maximum fine of $25. With all the fees that between the courts that this body and this legislature and the state has put on, it's about $140 for that ticket right now. And we're talking about helping those that what's that, 56% qualify for public defenders. But you have that 57th percentage person, probably just as much in trouble as that one that's at 56%. We're not talking about them. We want to be, in fact, our governor campaigned on one Minnesota. We should treat everybody the same. Instead of just reducing, allowing some people have it waived, I think you were absolutely right. We need to look at total reduction of some of these fees. Get them down where they belong. In fact, two years ago, we passed a law that cities and departments cannot use traffic stops as part of the officer's review. I know for me, it got to the point where traffic citations were so high in the community I lived in, I quit writing them unless they were very over the top, because it was unaffordable for most people to pay those tickets. And this legislative body is the one who put it to that point. So I think we need to take in not just the selected few having these reduced or waived. Let's take a hard look in totally reducing all these fees on these people that make it hardship. Because I know people that have actually paid their fines, paid their surcharges, but we went to a one-shop stop for paying citations. They paid them. Information was not relayed to the court system in the county that the citation was issued. Their licenses were suspended. The only reason I found out about it, and these were friends of mine, is because we'd get a notice every week of those licenses that were suspended. I'd see their names on that list. I'd call them up. They had documentation that they paid their fines, but the state still made them pay their restitution fees to get their license back. We have a lot of problems we need to fix, and I think the first one is just start cutting the cost of these tickets and these citations by reducing the surcharges altogether.
Chair Lesh.
Thank you. And I don't know, I mean, Mr. Walls and Mr. Johnson have not been tasked with looking at this, but I think the reason why we didn't do that is because the fiscal loan would be super high, right? But this is one thing that frustrates me is, we're only too willing to, at a time of deficit, pile on, and as they say in the Army, crap flows downhill. They actually say it more vulgar than that, but point is that people get stuck with paying for it when we're in a deficit. Now when we're in a surplus, I say, oh great, we can do all this other stuff. No, we still got to fix some of the stuff that we did back in those deficit years and make it more fair. And I agree with you. Yeah, I don't think we should have surcharge on this stuff either. Maybe we need to wait for another surplus. No.
And I just had a follow-up question to that. So the court here, though, could still consider a number of factors, right? The person doesn't have to necessarily be at a certain income level in order to qualify for that. Is this correct?
Yes, that's correct, Madam Chair. Has to consider ability to pay. So there's not a bright line of, qualifying for a public defender.
Okay. Thank you. Let's see. Chair Considine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Lesh, for bringing us forward. It was a good time when you first brought it. It was good when Representative Zerwas brought it. It's good this year. It disproportionately affects the people that can't pay. And we heard in testimony last year that of people that lost their jobs, lost their cars, lost their homes. And it was a penalty for being poor. And so I'm hoping that we can get this to go forward. And, again, thanks for bringing it forward.
Thank you. Any comment, Chair Lesh?
No, I agree.
All right. Yeah,
thank you for that.
Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Lesh, thank you very much for bringing this bill. I, too, think this is really good stuff. I'm so glad that you're working on this. I just had a question. We were talking about the fiscal note, and I realize it's an old one, and we don't have a new one yet, but I just wondered, I wanted to ask Mr. Walls, I don't even know if our fiscal notes can do this, but does the fiscal note or could the fiscal note reflect the what one of the testifiers talked about, that if these, when these surcharges are there, that sometimes people go ahead and take their case to court because they want to try to avoid the surcharge, and that is a cost in the system too. So if we're not doing that, are we doing less of that? There should be perhaps a savings. But I don't know if that savings is too speculative or too hard to quantify that it can't be incorporated into the fiscal note. But I would think that that would help bring down the cost.
Mr. Wells?
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, it's not my experience that they've ever looked at that before. I'm not sure that would work if how a person would get the fees waived without an appearance to prove that they had some form of some they were indigent. So I'm not exactly sure how that would work, but it hasn't been my experience that they've ever fiscal noted proposals in that fashion before.
Could Ms. Hang speak to that, Madam Chair?
Sure. Yes, go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as I said, you know, this has been something I've asked a lot, and I don't know that it's realistic if we'll ever get data to support it. What I can tell you is we have 3 afternoons a week in Minneapolis for these petty misdemeanor trials. They're trials to a judge, and routinely we have 7 to 10 cases on a day. That is a minimum of 1 police officer. We're paying several $100 to be there. We're using 1 full-time attorney who, frankly, could be used for more serious cases there. We have a referee. We have a court staff person, all of that for those cases. And it's not just the surcharge on this. A parking ticket has a $12 surcharge. That has been raised over the years. It used to be 4. And we have at least 3 or 4 people contesting parking tickets simply because the surcharge puts those tickets up $30 or $40. And so I don't know if we can ever quantify it, but I do think you're correct in thinking about when you're looking at resources, the resources that we're spending to give people their absolute right. If someone, regardless of ability to pay, if they just feel like they didn't do it, they absolutely have a right to have a trial. But for someone to set a case for a trial simply to try to get a reduced fee is not a good use of anyone's resources. And again, I do think that one thing I think Jeanette and I have both seen with our work as prosecutor and public defender is I think that for the most part, there's a fair number of people that want to be responsible, and they understand they did something wrong, and they want to be accountable, but they want to be treated fairly. And I think that if we lessen some of the collateral consequences and the financial impact for some of these minor offenses, you know, we're not talking about people who are out there driving drunk and really public safety risk. You know, the people going 100 miles an hour, you're going 5 miles over the speed limit. I think what we find is that people want to be responsible, and they will be responsible, and they'll if they can't afford it, they'll just go online and they'll pay their ticket and they'll be done. But we've tacked on so many collateral consequences to your driver's license, to the your financial impact. I think we've almost deterred people from being responsible. And what we found in our work in this restorative court and other things is that when given a chance to step up, people are very happy to do it if we give them something that they can reasonably do. And so I don't know that we can ever quantify it, but I think that fiscal note, it is not a sign. And I think the other thing, as Ms. Odegaard said, the reality is now when you're looking at the number of tickets issued, you're saying you should be bringing in X amount of income. You can't look at it that way. You have to look at what are people actually paying. If 50% of that is not being paid now, you're not getting that revenue anyway. And so I think if more people pay tickets, you might see revenue go up because they're actually paying their tickets. And again, it's just anecdotal in my own experience of 20 plus years, but I think that you're correct in thinking about those things.
Thank you. Anything else, Charlie? Okay. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lesh, I just have some specific questions about the bill and trying to understand if it's the same or different. I know that you had a testifier that said it was slightly different than Zerwas's bill. And specifically to that point, on page 5, line 5.24 through 5.26, it talks about the reinstatement fee. Can you just let us know it's deep in statutory references. Can you let us know what that would be?
Representative O'Neill, we're in HF 1060. Do you happen to have 1061?
Oh, you're right. I grabbed the wrong one.
Sorry. We're all looking for page 5 and we don't have it.
Yep. No, sorry.
All right. Will you save that question for the next?
Yes, I will save that for the next one. Great. Sorry about that. Then the question is, can you just let us know what is different than the previous bill that we had heard before with Representative Zerwas?
Okay. Could I phone a friend on that, Madam Chair?
You can, and your friend is on her way down. Go ahead, Ms. Odegaard. Did I say that right?
Yes, no. Perfectly. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative O'Neill. We made one small change to the bill working with Mr. Johnson, and it was to correct some language that had a consequence we hadn't intended. The language that was in Representative Zerwas's bill last year would have required people whose violation was on the payables list that Mary Ellen referred to come into court to have an assessment of their ability to pay. That would create an incredible burden on the court. We didn't actually intend that. We have changed the language so that the requirement that the court assess a person's ability to pay applies to people whose case is being heard in court. It doesn't require anybody who wouldn't otherwise be called into court to be called into court. I believe that's the only change we made.
Thank you. Any follow-up, Representative O'Neill?
I do, actually.
Okay.
Also, when the court is making findings on the record, are we including more than just petty misdemeanors or misdemeanors? Are there other crimes that are also being included in this particular bill?
Madam Chair? Go ahead. Thank you. Yes, we haven't made a distinction. I don't believe there's any distinction in the language here between a petty misdemeanor, gross, or a felony. The requirement is that any case that's being heard in court, that there be an assessment of ability to pay if that before the judge would impose a sentence that includes any kind of payment, so a fine, a fee, or a surcharge, whatever level of a violation that is.
Representative O'Neill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it could include a felony, a gross misdemeanor. There's no distinction.
Madam
Chair? So it's not just parking tickets. And
that's right. Go ahead.
Oh, okay.
Well, yeah, Madam Chair?
Go ahead.
Representative O'Neill, I'd ask you to keep in mind that technically that's supposed to be covered by the overall penalty. So this is not, you've got this is just the surcharge, but the fine amount is something that can be set by the judge that takes into consideration the level of the offense or how bad it is. The reason why we're dealing with just the surcharge is that's indiscriminate to the level of offense, and it obviously hits the most, the lowest. But maybe Ms. Hang can answer better.
Thank you.
Yes, and Representative O'Neill, that is correct. There are certain statutes that set the mandatory minimum fine for a various level of offense. For a misdemeanor, the mandatory minimum is a $300 fine. Unless they are indigent, they can do a $50 fine. Mm-hmm. There's a level for a gross misdemeanor, and then certain felony statutes carry their own specific fine penalties. So those will stay in place, and the judges will impose fines appropriately based on the charge, based on ability to pay. But this surcharge applies across the board. So any case that's charged that's considered criminal, the court makes a distinction between a criminal offense and a parking offense. So you have different surcharges for those. But any criminal offense, petty misdemeanor, speeding ticket up to a felony, whatever fine is imposed, that $75 will also be imposed. And right now, that can't be waived. Even on a felony, a judge may stay the entire fine, they still have to impose that $75.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, so thank you. So we're not talking solely about parking violations that a driver's license has been suspended, but really the entire criminal code where a surcharge is being assessed. So that's a little different than, I think, what the earlier conversation was. I just want to make sure that we understand what we're doing here.
Yes, Representative O'Neill, this will impact every single criminal case. I think where we see the impact most are on those lower-level cases because people simply just want to pay off their ticket, and the fine is often disproportionately low compared to that surcharge. On a felony, the fine is likely going to be higher. But at the same time, if they're public defender eligible, the court will stay portions of that fine so that it's an appropriate level of fine on that case. But yes, the surcharge is just it's the administrative fee that goes on top of whatever the fine is, which is the penalty for whatever the level of the offense is.
Right.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. I just wanted to make sure I understood what the bill is doing.
And I have a sort of a follow-up question to that, too. I just want to be clear that this doesn't impact restitution amounts at all. Is that correct?
Correct. In fact, I think it will help in restitution because, again, if I have a victim, one of the cases that we commonly see at the misdemeanor level are people driving without insurance. And then we have a victim who has at least maybe their own deductible or thousands of dollars in damage that the defendant agrees to pay. And we would much rather see them be making payments towards that than paying a $75 surcharge. So what we're doing here today with this bill does not impact restitution all other than it hopefully will increase the ability to pay off that restitution to make our victims whole.
Great. Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, to the current testifier, in this bill, I'm looking through it, and I have a bad feeling this might increase court cases, because the way I read this, in order to get that reduction, you actually have to go to court. Is that correct?
Missing.
Yes, Representative Johnson. Not to give you too much, but the system is set up. There are certain misdemeanor and petty misdemeanor cases that have been dubbed by the state court as a payable offense. So what that means is, like a speeding ticket, they have set a set amount and plus a surcharge. And so you can go online, put your ticket in, and they'll say, if you just want to plead guilty, here's what you owe. And that has to be that whole amount. For a driving after revocation, that amount is a $200 fine. So if you don't want to come to court and fight that you were driving after revocation, you can simply pay $200 plus the $75 plus whatever fees and be done with it. And that is all done computerized through the state court system. And with this bill, what this was the issue last year, is I don't think technology has caught up to be able to do that. Ideally, that would be perfect if there was a way that someone could go online, put in some financial information, and it could say, well, we'll reduce your surcharge by this. But we're not at that point. So if someone feels like it's either too high and they want to come and argue for a lesser fine or surcharge, or they simply can't pay it, they would have to come to court to do it. The payables only work if you're willing to pay the full amount.
Representative Johnson.
That was my concern even last year, because I think it's going to increase our burdens on our court system. That's why I think I personally like to see all the surcharges and that stuff reduced, because I think that will actually free up more court time.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Grassl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Lesh, thanks for your work that you've done on this bill thus far. You and Zerwas working together is good, as this is a bipartisan issue, something that we can always try to do better, try to improve on things. With you saying the change in the culture of law enforcement, I'll have to take a step back and say, I've been doing this for years. The majority of law enforcement officers have been doing this for years, trying to watch out for those who we know. We see on the roads, we see out in the counties that we know cannot afford these kind of tickets, these kind of charges on them. So we've always been trying to help to make sure that, you know, they need to fix something, go home and fix this stuff. And I'll come back with some proof that you have insurance, so on and so forth. We've tried to cut them, keep people breaks many, many, many times, because I know what a bag of groceries costs back home. I know that if a week of groceries that a family will have to do without. So, I mean, this is work that law enforcement's been doing for years. And I'm glad legislation is starting to catch up with this. And I guess, you know, the only thing, if this bill doesn't pass, I mean, what happens?
Chair Lesh.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Grassl, if the bill doesn't pass, we end up with the same status quo, and we end up with more snowballing cycles of poverty. I think this has attempted to be addressed through the driving diversion programs in certain counties that offer those driver diversion programs. It sets up a lot of hoops that you have to jump through, and it's one way that I think various jurisdictions have attempted to solve what's become a ballooning problem with the ballooning surcharges. That will probably still try to manage this with a duct tape and bailing wire operation a patchwork of diversion programs as best we can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Lesh, for bringing this forward. I was unaware of a lot of these surcharges in the system before Ms. Odegaard came and spoke with me in my office, and I appreciate the time she took with me. And so I fully agree that these surcharges are unnecessary and really put people behind unnecessarily. But to the point that was raised earlier about the payment online, first of all, I would support just getting rid of the surcharges across the board. So I'm all in for that. I think the punishment should fit the crime, and the fees for the parking tickets or the speeding tickets are probably appropriate the surcharges have nothing to do with the crime. So I don't know why, you know, I understand it was a budget issue when we got to this place, but perhaps we could roll that back across the board. But when the punishment does fit the crime and people still are unable to pay, I think it would be helpful if we could somehow work with this online payment system so that people wouldn't have to pay the whole amount at once. Right now it's all or nothing, and I think we have the technology. We should allow them to pay $10 a month until they've paid for the punishment part of the ticket personally. And I know that's a separate issue, but I'd just like to have the chair consider how we might also maybe address that so that in online payments for the punishment part, it's also more manageable.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative, I agree with you 100%. And once in a while I will nerd out about the payables list and what's happened. Now, this legislature had passed legislation for a long time permitting the Supreme Court to assign certain misdemeanors to a payables list. That means you can pay them, as Ms. Hang described, without going into court. That has been the case for a long time. However, when the Supreme Court wanted to move to the e-filing system, in order to manage caseloads for that, they had to obviously reduce caseloads and move a lot of these cases over to being payables. So they took, and in fact, I've heard the story about from some old-timers who were here, that back when they started, the only thing on the payables list was like bear baiting or something. It was a gross misdemeanor, and you could pay it. You know, that was like in the 80s or something like that. Well, that slowly expanded by the Supreme Court. The Judicial Council expanded it more and more and more. Then they wanted to move to e-filing 10 years ago, and they said, well, in order to make this work, we got to put a whole chunk of cases on the payables list. I, as a legislator, have told the Supreme Court multiple times, you guys don't set the levels of crimes in this state. The legislature sets the level of crimes. So you can't take a gross misdemeanor or a misdemeanor and make it a petty by virtue of just putting on the payables list. We allowed them to do that for efficiency's sake for many, many years. In my opinion, when they wanted to move to a payables list and put all these crimes on there, I believe it was an abuse of power. That sounds pejorative, but because we all kind of do that around here, but branch-wise, okay?
Yourself.
Yeah, I know. No, the branches do. But the point is, it way overstepped the bounds of, I think, what the judicial branch should have done, and sometimes the legislature oversteps that as well. But I think you're right in the sense that, in my opinion, if we're going to allow the Supreme Court to continue to overstep that, in my opinion, we should ask for some quid pro quo and ask them, hang on a second, why does it have to be the entire chunk? Why can't you allow for payment plans or something like that? I think that's a completely fair give and take that would achieve the purposes of having good government.
Thank you.
Okay, let's see, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just to the point of the driver diversion program, so in 2017, the legislature took action and essentially eliminated the ability to do the driver diversion program. I know that because there was a very successful one in Wright County, and they got crushed. And I won't name the member that decided that was a bad idea, but he had, in his view, something that happened in his county that he wasn't happy with. So he eliminated the free-flowing ability for the counties to do driver diversion programs. So that might be something we could revisit because it was incredibly successful in Wright County. It wasn't successful in another one, but just to note that was changed in 2017.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative O'Neill. I have a bill this year that I'm bringing as well on behalf of the driver diversion program. So.
And Ms. Hing, did you have a comment on that too?
Yes, Representative Neal. And I think actually the issue with that particular program was it's very different than the driving diversion program that we're working with now that my office works with and others in the state, was that they essentially started treating these traffic tickets as administrative tickets. And what the issue was that by doing that, it essentially eliminated this surcharge. And then the state wasn't getting its money, and that was the legal issue that I think eventually brought that program down. It was tied to this surcharge. If we have authority to treat certain very limited offenses as an administrative citation, which means there's no surcharge to it, but then the city has to have a hearing officer, there's other complications. We don't do it in Minneapolis because it's not cost-effective. But it's interesting you bring that up because I think that whole program was tied into this discussion and why that program ended up going away because this surcharge exists in the way it does.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, that would be an absolute accurate depiction of what had happened. And I would even take it one step further, not in Wright, because I know how they operated there, but in the other county, there was accusations that we're using that money to, you know, buy equipment and something for the police department and so on. So it, they weren't doing that in Wright. But if we could revisit that and make it more palatable for the state, I think it's an incredible opportunity for people to learn from their mistakes and move forward and maybe stop the crazy behavior that got them there in the first place.
All right. Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Representative Grossel.
I'll be quick, Madam Chair. Thank you. Mr. Chair, would you consider, you know, since I think it's pretty much the consensus around the table and yourself, that these surcharges were something that were imposed in a time of deficit and in a time where we were needing to try to get things balanced back out, would you consider a reduction overall these surcharges for all Minnesotans? Since, you know, I'm confident that the governor and the majority and our legislature will continue to legislate in a way that we are continuing to have a surplus. I mean, is there anything that you could work on this to either drastically reduce these surcharges or eliminate them completely?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Grossel, I would. I can pretty much guarantee you I won't get the amount in my target from our leadership to accommodate that entire thing. You know, I would say, you know, sure, if you guys all vote for it on the floor, the bill, but I'm willing to bet your leadership probably wouldn't let you do that. I don't know. It's the majority's job to pass our bills around here. I get that. I want to do that. If there was a way to thread that needle, you bet your bottom dollar I'd want to do that. It's going to be a little politically tricky. You guys, I expect, you know, you're probably going to vote against the bill on the floor, too, and then I got to cobble together the votes to make it happen so that it doesn't violate the budget resolution, et cetera, et cetera. If there's a way to thread that needle, I want to do it.
Representative Grossel.
I think this would be something that would be good for everybody, and I think you might find more cooperation than what you're thinking.
All right. It looks like we are getting close to time. We still have another bill. We haven't opened it up to the audience yet. Is there anyone from the audience who wishes to testify? Okay. Any further comments, Representative Lesh?
Madam Chair and members, I appreciate the Love Fest. everyone loves it. This is great. I hope we can continue to do it. If it is partial and not full, sometimes we solve problems here incrementally, and I think this is one small way that we can do it. I will tell you that over the years, I first became a prosecutor in 2001, and I first got elected here in 2002. My first session was 2003. That was the year of the whopping budget deficit, $5.4 billion total between the budget we had to pass as well as the existing then current shortfall. We did all kinds of things that both sides of the aisle didn't really want to do. I think more DFLers were resistant even more, but regardless, both sides of the aisle didn't want to do it. This was one of them, and in the years that I prosecuted almost exclusively in Ramsey County as a prosecutor, I can't even count the number of times that a judge on the bench would look down at the defendant and say, yes, no, I get it, and you're right, but I cannot waive that. The law does not permit me to waive it, and I'll send you downstairs to administration to pay your fines, and they don't care if I say you don't have to pay that surcharge because you shouldn't be paying it, but you're going to have to go talk to the legislature about that, and then the judge and at the bench would kind of look at me and glare at me because I was in the legislature at the same time. And I'd like to avoid those glares in the future, but not just because I'd like to avoid the glares. This is the right thing to do. So I appreciate your support on this, and I ask for your vote.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. It looks like we maybe had a couple more questions, but just to clarify, this bill's going to be coming back here at some point or not? I know we're moving it, but will it ever come back here?
Yes.
Okay. All right, so let's go ahead and get Representative Robbins. Did you have another question?
Just a very small one. Following up on Representative Grassl's question, I don't obviously know how this committee bill works, but is there any way that with the support of the full committee, we could just move this one bill separate from the whole committee bill and just have this on the floor and just say, I think it would solve so many problems in the system, and I think there's bipartisan support. Is there any, I don't know if bills ever move just as a single bill like that, but would that ever work?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Robbins, I don't know the last time this legislature has ever passed a single spending bill outside an omnibus bill. There may have been instances that we've done it with, I don't know, the research people are talking back and forth on this, but I can tell you it rarely ever happens except in, like, if there's, like, I don't know, tornado relief or something. But Mr. Walls, did you want to speak to that?
Mr. Chair, were you asking about moving the bill independently?
Well, yeah, Madam Chair, Mr. Walls, Representative Robbins talked about, you know, passing this as a single spending bill.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, bills can move independently. It depends on how leadership chooses to treat things. In the past, there have been a category in the budget resolution for other bills. They've given targets to major omnibus bills, and they've had a category for other bills where a bill can pass that may cost some money, and they're holding some dollars aside to pay for those. Customarily, this is something that would move in an omnibus bill, but it could go either way depending on whether or not the budget resolution is going to include a target for bills separate from the major omnibus bills.
Okay. And Madam Chair and Representative Robbins, you know, my first job as chair of this committee is to pass an omnibus spending bill. And I can tell you, you know, I like that you guys like this bill, but I'm probably not going to carve this off and send it on its own just so you guys will vote for it. I mean, I got to.
I didn't know how it worked.
Yeah. But, you know, it's a good question. You know, there are a lot of questions revolving around how we do expenditures around the legislature. You know, there are other committees that have, like, there's no way you can fund, like, Health and Human Services without doing it in an omnibus bill. It's, you know, it's impossible to fund government that way, but it's a good question. It's fair.
Okay. All right. Right now, I renew the motion that House File 1060 be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. House File 1060 is recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee with the recommendation that it be referred to the Public Safety and Okay, we'll just say House File 1060 is recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All right, we've got House File 1061 next. It's a bill that modifies the Commissioner of Public Safety's authority to suspend driver's license in certain situations and provides for retroactive driver's license reinstatement in certain instances. Chair Lesh, would you like to move this bill, House File 1061, before the committee to be recommended that it be re-referred to the Public Safety, Criminal Justice Reform, Finance, and Policy Division?
Madam Chair, that is my motion.
All right. Chair Lesh, please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
So thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is tangentially related to the last bill we did because it's specific to driver's license suspension. So this would stop driver's license suspensions when the only violation is a failure to pay traffic tickets and eliminate the additional suspension period after paying a ticket for driving after suspension so people can pay their fine and get back to work. This relates to the cycle that I described where people can't afford to pay a speeding ticket. They get their license suspended due to that. They drive with a suspended license, and then their license is revoked on top of being suspended. And then after a few of those, we start making them do jail time. So it permits the ability of a judge to say, we're not going to suspend this person's license.
And it maintains the collections process so people are still accountable to pay their tickets, but it does not impact suspensions for DWI, reckless driving, or habitual offenders. It's just those folks that I've talked about who get into that negative cycle based on the circumstances that I've discussed. So about 55,000 Minnesota driver's licenses are suspended, not for dangerous driving violations, but just for unpaid traffic tickets. National data shows that 44% of these people whose license is suspended lose their jobs. Organizations as politically diverse as ALEC, the National Center for State Courts, and the Southern Poverty Law Center, imagine them all in one room, they've all documented the enormous economic and fiscal impact of suspending driver's license for unpaid court debt. These bills are the product of broad stakeholder agreement, including prosecutors, defense attorneys, right-on-crime organizations, faith-based groups, and community organizations. So with that, I would introduce you to Leah Jackson, who's going to speak to you about some of the details.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. Ms. Jackson, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Sure. Thanks, Madam Chair, and the members of the committee. So my name is Leah Jackson. I grew up in Otsego, Minnesota, and I now live in Minneapolis. And I am a server and a bartender and a dance teacher through St. Paul Parks and Rec. Thanks for the chance for me to tell you about how this has impacted me, both financially and occupationally. So it started in October 2014. I was taking a left turn at a green light yield, and I pulled out into the intersection like I was taught how to do, and I was waiting for the break in traffic to give me the time to turn. Well, all the other cars started rolling through as soon as that light turned yellow, and I didn't make it through until it turned red. And I was pulled over immediately and was told that that was illegal, even though that's what I was taught how to do. But I was given a ticket for obstructing traffic, an intersection gridlock, which at the time was $135. And I was 20. I was out of town on training for a brand new job as a store manager, and I had just moved into my very own apartment for the first time. So I didn't really have, the means to pay $135 right away. So I had to save up for rent. I wasn't sure how long I had to pay the ticket because that was never really fully told to me. I figured I would get to it after a few paychecks, got my feet on the ground. The following February, I was pulled over and told my license was suspended. And I was given a driving after suspension ticket. So I ended up paying $200, but if I remember right, it was like $280-something for the ticket originally, with all the fees and surcharges that were added on there. So even though I was never notified of the suspension, and I had just moved again, so they didn't have my address, but it was my parents' address, which was still my mailing address, so I still should have gotten a notice, which I never did. So now, with that total, it was about $500 now with the combined. So now I wouldn't, again, knew I wouldn't be able to pay it until I got my tax return since it was February. Part of my responsibility at work was to make daily bank runs for the store that I worked at, and then do deliveries, like tuxedo deliveries and stuff like that, which I couldn't do, which my boss was not happy. So within about 2 weeks, I received two more driving after suspension tickets, one making a bank run and one driving to my second job as a dance teacher. He was not happy and not threatening to fire me, but definitely implied that that would have happened if I didn't get everything figured out. So stress of that trouble, because I was in trouble at work, I couldn't visit my family, who lived about 50 minutes away from me at the time, and then I just couldn't save any money. When my tax refund finally came back, I actually went to court and I talked with a hearing officer who was able to reduce my fines. So the three driving after suspension tickets, it was about $900. I ended up paying only six. So that was kind of happy because that was a lot less than $900. But I paid it off and I was actually able to get my license back right away. But that wasn't the end of my problem. So with those tickets, my auto insurance dropped me. So I wasn't able to continue my car insurance with that company. And if I was able to find insurance, it was like $1,000 a month. So I was lucky that I was connected through an insurance broker, through a restaurant customer at the time. His son actually was a broker, and he gave me his phone number. And I was able to get insurance for $650 a month. So now it's 4.5 years later, and I still pay $200, which is a lot better. That was actually this month that I was able to start paying $200. So the total cost of these tickets, plus the increase in auto insurance that I've been paying over the last 4.5 years, is a little less than $16,000. So if my license hadn't been suspended, I would have been able to continue driving for work. I wouldn't have been in trouble. I would have been able to keep that car insurance because it was USAA. That's like the best deal you can get. And I would have, you know, been able to save that money for tax returns. I just hope that the legislature will be able to figure out a way to stop suspending the driver's license for people who might not be able to pay it at the time, because $16,000 later could have been avoided if I just had a little bit more time.
Thank you so much for sharing your story. We really appreciate you being here. Thank you. Let's see, Chair Lesh, I think you had Ms. Hing to testify again on this bill?
Yes.
All right. Ms. Hing, if you want to come forward.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mary Ellen Hing, criminal deputy at Minneapolis City Attorney's Office. Again, I echo everything Chair Lesh said. As a prosecutor, in Minneapolis, about 30% of our caseload, so cases we handle in court, are driving after revocation, driving after suspension. And again, you know, that's a lot of attorney time, paralegal time, because we have discovery responsibilities, you know, court time for these kind of cases where the sole reason of the suspension is the financial inability to pay fine. I agree. I'm not here to say we shouldn't have suspension or revocation for bad conduct, but as a prosecutor, that's what I want to focus on, is the conduct that is endangering our citizens, the bad driving, the failing to yield to pedestrians, the careless driving, the running red lights. Those are the things we should be focusing our resources on. I've been working with the Driver Diversion Program to help people reinstate their licenses for about 10 years now, and this is the program that was set up through a session law to allow people to have a payment plan, because we just don't have that ability in court. And some of the cases that I have reviewed, I have seen upwards of $10,000 or $12,000 in fines and fees owed by people for the accumulation of traffic tickets. I have a very good paying job. My husband is employed. That's a lot of money for my household. And we're talking about people, you know, that are not making nearly that much money. I mean, that amount is just staggering, because what happens is you have the fine amount, then you add on the surcharge and the law library fee, all that we've talked about. But then when I don't pay my ticket, the court will send you a notice. Hey, Ms. Hang, your ticket's late. That's a $5 late fee. Then they're going to wait another 20, 30 days. Then they're going to send me another $5 late fee. Then eventually they're going to send it off to collections, and I'm going to have at least a $25 collection fee or more and a $25 delinquency fee, and all of those fees are compounded. And that's if I'm charged with one offense. Some law enforcement agencies, as has been said here, some officers understand, and so they do try to give people breaks. You are driving after suspension, and maybe you also ran a red light and other violations, and they might say, I'm just going to give you one citation. There are some law enforcement agencies that do not do that, and you will see a ticket for driving after suspension, not being able to provide proof of insurance, the moving violation, and maybe an equipment violation. When you're adding three or four counts, one ticket alone, I've seen a ticket be over $800 for one offense. And, yes, did they commit all those offenses? Sure they did. But at one ticket, $800, then you add on the late fees, the collection fees, and all of that, and then you just form this hole, and they can't get out of the hole. And the other piece of this legislation is the reason we support the driving diversion program is if we can get people where they're in a position to start paying off their fees and being accountable and they're doing a payment plan. The other side of that coin is when you plead guilty to a ticket, there's going to be the collateral consequence to your license. Now you have one, two, three additional convictions, and you might face a 30, 60, 90-day further suspension for trying to do the right thing. And at least in the DDP, the state has agreed we will not impose that extra suspension. And I believe that's also part of this bill, is to stop that collateral consequence for certain offenses, because it doesn't make any sense. I've finally gotten on my feet. I'm willing to be accountable, pay these tickets. Great, you paid that ticket, but you still can't drive for 30 more days because we suspended you as an additional consequence. And it puts people in a very bad position. They have to decide, do I drive to go to work? Frankly, they have to drive to get to court. If they don't show up for court, these are misdemeanors. They're going to get a bench warrant. And so we know, if I watched a lot of the defendants in my courtroom walk out the door, I guarantee you they're walking right to their cars and getting in their cars and driving because, you know, we have really good public transportation, but it doesn't work for everyone. You know, you try to bring three little kids on a bus and transfer a bus three times to come for your DAR and see how easy it is. And so I think at some point we just have to be smarter, and where do we want to put our resources, and are we doing more harm than good? And I think with suspending people for their inability to pay, it doesn't make sense from a public safety standpoint. In fact, I argue it makes public safety, puts it more at risk, because when a driver's unlicensed, as you just heard, they frequently then don't have insurance. And in this weather, you can be doing everything you can to be driving really, really carefully and still slide into someone. And now we have a victim who, I drive a very, very old car. I only have liability insurance. So if I get in a crash, you know, I'm going to get a new car at some point. I'm okay with that. But others, that means I now no longer have a car. And now that victim can't get to work, can't pay their rent. And now we've put that person in a financial hole. So this is a really big issue that just permeates to more than just the criminal defendants that we're here talking about. It affects everyone, and I think it does put public safety at risk because we want licensed, insured drivers on the road. That's a better use of all of our time in public safety.
Great. Thank you. And did you have one other testifier? Is Ms. Borner testifying again on this one? And I would just note that we do have several questions, so if you could keep that in mind, we have time still. But
I'll be short.
Thank you so much.
Again, Jeanette Berner, the First Assistant Public Defender in Hennepin County, and I'll just go off script a little bit here and in the interest of time. I don't think you can really undervalue the meaning of a driver's license to individuals in the community. We talk a lot about the city and the fact that, you know, poverty, but outstate Minnesota clients of ours suffer tremendously. There is no public transportation. There are no Ubers. There's no Lyfts. And individuals who cannot drive and cannot get a job remain in this incredibly vicious cycle. Make no mistake about it. This suspension does not reduce it. What it does is reduces gainful employment. It increases risky behavior. It increases the cost of insurance, as Ms. Hang said. And it shifts resources from needed resources away from the family. And it does not deter bad behavior. There's tons of studies that show it doesn't deter bad behavior, and it really doesn't generate any revenue, and it doesn't promote public safety. I'll just sort of leave you with this. Our office, we're burdened with a lot of cases, and you know, I'm sure you've heard from other members of my office about public defense funding and staffing. I'm sure you've heard that, right?
Yeah.
That's kind of funny. I listen to the rate of the increase in the surcharge, and I only wish our salaries increased at the same rate. I can't help but notice that. Anyway, as an aside, I think, you know, we have a lot of serious, serious cases, and we have a lot of clients in custody, and we want to be able to give them an excellent defense. What we find ourselves doing is spending an inordinate amount of time trying to work with individuals to get their licenses back, because we do care about each and every client, and it's resource and time that we could better spend. So lastly, what I will tell you is that there is a nationwide trend to remove the suspension of license for non-payment of fines, and I hope we're all a little competitive and we don't want to be last in line in Minnesota. The state of Washington stopped suspending driver's license for unpaid tickets in 2012. California in 2017, Mississippi in December of 2017. And just since our last session, the state of Tennessee, a federal court, said, and I quote, collecting debt from an indigent debtor is not a rational basis for revoking a license. No rational creditor wants his debtor to be sidelined from productive economic life or less able to hold a job or cover other competing living expenses. The loss of one's ability to drive compromises the person's capacity for economic self-sufficiency in ruling that they may no longer suspend driver's license for non-payment of fines. And I'm just really hoping that we don't have to engage in a court battle to make this happen, that I am confident we could win, that we can do this the simple, more efficient way that acknowledges what we all see is happening in our community. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's see. We have several questions here. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Lesch, can you talk just a little bit about the report? You haven't really talked much about the report that we're asking for to the legislature. And then the other question I have, just in the sake of time, is actually on page 5, and how much is the reinstatement fee, just because it's not spelled out in my information.
Thank you. If I could have my testifiers speak to that. This bill was the result of broad compromise and working with folks, and so they can speak more to the history about how the stakeholders were worked with and arriving at that. And the report was last year. Representative Zerwas carried all three of these. That was part of the third bill, was the report, as I recall. Is that right? The report was a separate third bill last year.
Do you want to
pull under this one? So if you can come up and testify.
Go ahead, Ms. Odegaard.
Speak to the report and first.
Introduce yourself one more time, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Anna Odegaard with the Minnesota Asset Building Coalition. And Madam Chair,
go ahead.
That's right. So last year there was a separate bill that included a requirement for some of this reporting, and we just added it. We decided to add it to the driver's license bill this year for simplicity. And to just do an overview of what that reporting is, we really would like it to be public information how many licenses are being suspended and revoked each year in the state of Minnesota, and what the underlying violation is. Because as the chairman explained, the driver's license suspension bill wouldn't impact the suspension or revocation for any of the dangerous driving offenses like DUI or reckless driving. It really would just stop the suspension for unpaid traffic tickets. And we have the aggregate number of those suspensions, but we don't know exactly how many of those suspensions are due to unpaid tickets versus some of the other violations. So it does require the Department of Public Safety to report on how many licenses are suspended and revoked each year for different violations. It also requires that there be a report by the state court administrator about how many driving after suspension and driving after revocation violations are charged each year. What we're really hoping to see is that if the driver's license suspension bill of Chairman Lesch's bill passes and people are able to retain that license while they work on paying off tickets, we're really hoping to see a reduction in the number of driving after suspension tickets. And so we are requiring a report on that so that we can see the impact of the bill. And then we're also asking for there to be reporting on how many of those basic traffic tickets, the payable tickets, currently are going to collections. And then after, hopefully, the passage of the surcharge waiver bill, we would see fewer of those tickets going to collections. And so we also ask for some reporting on how many tickets are going to collections with a breakdown of how many of those are public defender eligible cases and not.
Thank you. Representative O'Neill.
Yes, and then also to the question of the reinstatement fee, that's on page 5, lines 5.24 through 5.26. How much is the reinstatement fee?
Yeah. Okay, Ms. Hing.
Representative O'Neill, so for a non-DUI offense, it's $30. The interesting part of your question is that last year the state rolled out a new electronic system for driver's license. MNLARS was, I think, eventually supposed to cover both driver's license and vehicle registration, but they put a new online system just for the driver's licenses last year. And so if you have someone who has multiple tickets and you finally get to the point where you can get reinstated, you would pay that $30 fee once and then you would be reinstated. Now with the new online system, what I was told is under the old computer system, the reinstatement fee applies to each and every ticket. The system did not have the capacity to apply it. And so what it would do, it would look at all of your tickets and whatever your highest reinstatement fee is, that was what you were required to pay. Now it has the ability to impose it. So now you are paying a reinstatement fee for every ticket. So if I have 10 tickets, prior to that shift change last year, I would have paid $30. Now I'm paying 30 times 10. So the reinstatement fee really impacts the ability to get people valid, because now it's always been required on each ticket. They just didn't have the technological capacity to impose it, is my understanding, and now they do. And that is furthering digging the hole for people with their financial responsibilities when it comes to these tickets.
Representative O'Neill.
Okay, so now I'm more confused. So if you look at specifically in the language, it's referring to Section 171.20, Subdivision 4. And
we get a copy of the language up here.
I thought it said $20 in there, not $30, and I didn't see it that it was on every single ticket. But are you changing what you just said in this bill? I'm just really confused now.
Let me take a look at the language. And I could be, I thought it was $30, but it could be, it's $20 or $30 for sure.
Get the whip out.
Representative O'Neill, would you repeat what line you were looking at, please?
Yes, Madam Chair. It's line 5.24 through 5.26, and it's referring to section, it's statutory reference to 171.20 subdivision 4. I just was trying to figure out how much are we asking people for reinstating, and I think it's important to understand, is it $20, is it $30, is it on every single ticket, or is it, you know, put together in one fee to reinstate the license? I'm just really confused now. I thought I understood it, and now I'm really confused. So maybe we can get clarity.
If Ms. Hing, you can answer. I don't know if Mr. Johnson would be able to answer that question either. So go ahead, Ms. Hing.
In looking at this language, I think it would require the reinstatement fee to be imposed. And I believe it's 30, but I could be wrong. It's 20 or 30. I know it's in that range. And every ticket, every time you get suspended, that's an act. And every act of suspension then requires the reinstatement fee to be paid. So this law wouldn't change this, and I believe it would still require that to be paid on every ticket for which you were suspended. I don't think when we drafted this, that system was not in place, and this was something that came to our attention relatively late in the year, that now these – so I think if you had 10 tickets, you would pay the reinstatement fee on all those unless some other change was put into the law, because right now – you know, if you're suspended on every ticket, I think there would be a fee, and so we might have to look at that.
Okay, thank you. I think Mr. Johnson has something to add.
Madam Chair, members, Representative O'Neill, I think what you're looking at in Section 171.20 Subdivision 4 are some cross-references. Included in the cross-references is a reference to Section 171.16, mm-hmm. Subdivisions 2 and 3. Mm-hmm. That is generally those are generally catch-all provisions. Subdivision 2 says the court may recommend the suspension of the driver's license of the person so convicted, which is basically conviction for any moving violation, and shall suspend the license as recommended. And then Subdivision 3 relates to suspension for failing to pay the fine. I believe those are effectively catch-all provisions, which results in most, if not all, licenses being suspended following the moving violations.
Representative O'Neill.
So, Madam Chair, so help me understand. So is this it's not a one-time fee of $20 to get your license back. It's a fee on every single ticket. Is that accurate or not? Because that would be a big difference between $20 and, say, $200.
Well,
Chair Lesh.
On every ticket that would require suspension. So, yes. If you get any of these tickets that fall under the categories that this legislature determines require suspension, then it would. So, for example, you're going triple digits anywhere. That's automatic revocation, right? So it's not just suspension. But there are a laundry list of crimes in statute that fall under that require suspension. You have to pay for those.
Representative O'Neill.
Okay. Yeah, I was just trying to understand, like, how much for asking people after they paid these huge fines to now pay more to get their license back. I'm just trying to understand, like, how much it was. It was confusing in the language. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. We have four more questions, and we have 5 minutes. So if you could try to keep it quick, that would be great. Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, a little bit of a comment here. First of all, the report, I really would love to see that report before we act on this to find out what the actual issue is. And I think we passed the previous bill that we did. I think that's going to reduce, especially if we reduce the surcharge, it's going to reduce the number of people that have their citation or their licenses suspended for unpaid fines. But there was a comment earlier about stacked citation. I was going to give a reason why law enforcement officers are doing that. It happened to me when I'm in my law enforcement career. I've given a person, decided to give a person a break. Instead of writing the four or five charges I could, I just wrote them on one that was actually in the middle because I knew the person had been on some hard times and stuff, but they still wrote them for the driving after suspension. I didn't write a few others, including the insurance and the speeding and the fleeing. I was giving them a good break. He ended up taking it to court. And I got raked over the coals by the public defender for not what was my probable cause for the stop? Because why didn't you give him a ticket for this? Why didn't you give him a ticket for that? Why didn't you give him a ticket for that? Word travels in the law enforcement community. Because of that, most people are writing the stack tickets. So that's what happens. We've got to be careful how we do this. Law enforcement want to give break. They don't want to. There's a few people that we've dealt with 45 times for speeding and driving and stuff. Yeah, we'll stack them because they are not learning and not learning their lesson. But generally, law enforcement want to help the community. We want to keep the road safe. You're driving a lot. You're speeding a lot, running through stop signs. We want to write those tickets. The question I have on this issue, though, is how many tickets, citations for speeding, running stop signs, passing in no passing zones, and not paying the fines should a person get before we do suspend their license?
Chair Lesh.
Well, Madam Chair and Chair Johnson, I don't know, but this still allows for a judge to make that determination. You know, the repeat habitual offenders at a certain point. No, we're not looking at doing that. Yeah. Oh, so yeah, it is. That's true. So on the petties, we still have this in law. It's 4 in a year and 5 in 2 years of even speeding going 66 and a 65. You get 4 of those in a year. It's suspended. We're not changing that. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to make a sort of a parallel argument for what we're doing here, and I think it's a good thing to do. And one of the previous testifiers said that you can't undervalue the value of a driver's license to people. And some of you know that I work heavily in the family law arena down here, and I can't tell you how many times I've heard that, why do you take someone's driver's license away for non-payment of child support? How does that help them provide for their child, and why do you jail them for the same thing? And I believe in the state of Minnesota that you only have to be behind on your child support for 3 months and they'll suspend your driver's license. And I think that is, there's no positivity that can come out of that, in my opinion. And I think there's some federal law that says that you have to do this, and maybe it's federal law, too, that you have to throw these people in jail for non-payment. And I understand if you have the means to pay, but so many of these people don't have the means to pay once they get behind on things like this. And, you know, 3 months, if somebody loses their job, it may take them 6 months to find a new one. And in the meantime, they're without a vehicle. They can't drive for job interviews or once they do get a job. And so I am hopeful that maybe something can be done about that in the future as we look towards leveling the playing field. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Representative Hassan.
Did you pass?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Chair Lesh, thank you for bringing this bill forward. I think it's really important. I remember on 2017, the end of 2017, Minneapolis police dashboard confirmed that, yes, black people are stopped more than the average people. So when you are stopped more than the average person, of course you're going to get a ticket. Every time police stops, even if you didn't do anything wrong, you could, you know, just interact with the police. Maybe they don't like your attitude, maybe they don't like your tone, they'll still give you a ticket. And for people, you know, knowing the disparities in Minnesota, you know, I think this impacts black and brown folks in Minnesota more than any other group of people. So thank you for bringing this forward.
Chair Constein.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair Lesh. Again, I like this bill a lot, and I believe it is critical that we pass it. As a number of you probably are aware, there are bills that are being circulated to enhance certain penalties for driving after suspension. And I think it's critical that we make sure that we are eliminating these before that happens. Thank you.
And Representative Grossel.
Very brief, Chair Lesh. It seems to me that the citation they're too high. The cost is too high. And the cost is too high for everybody, especially those who are working on a lower income. And so, I mean, I'm looking at this. Is there a fiscal note for this one, too?
Chair Lesh?
No.
Mr. Walls?
Mr. Chair, Representative Grossel, the fiscal note was requested on this bill. However, the two bills that these are a combination of from the previous year that were authored by Representative Zerwas, there was a fiscal note done on the reporting requirement that came back with a zero from the courts. There was a small cost to driver and vehicle services to for some clerical work around the main structure of the bill, and that was from the driver and vehicle services fund. And I believe there's a way to that they had worked out with DVS last year to pay for that.
Chair Lesh, I found you some more money then. for the first bill you presented,
yeah.
You take the finances from this one, put it into the first one, get rid of those surcharges, not get those citation costs down to where they should be, and I think we can solve a whole lot of problems with less legislation.
Well,
is there anyone in it, Representative Lesh, did you have a comment to that? And then I wanted to open it up for the audience.
No, I was going to say, I mean, I Representative Grossel, I hope we could do that. I know that you know, we depend on agencies to do the fiscal notes, and even if you put things together and you think we should be in net savings, or the agency comes back and eye-popping numbers say, well, no, you didn't save anything. So it depends on them, but it is a good idea.
Is there anyone from the audience who wanted to testify about this bill? All right. Seeing none, I renew the motion that House File 1061 be recommended that it be re-referred to the Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform Finance and Policy Division. All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 1061 is recommended to be re-referred to the Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform Finance and Policy Division. Members, our next meeting will be on Tuesday, February 19th, and we'll have the public defenders make their budget presentation and hear Bill House File 400. Do you have a comment, Representative? With that, the meeting's adjourned.